Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Jody Peterman. We know that no one understands what you need better than you do. We take care to guide you through the legal process, ensuring that you're able to make the decisions that are best for you. If you have a personal injury, criminal, or family law issue, please take a look at our website to learn more about our practice. We offer a free initial consultation for personal injury cases. Give us a call at 229-375-5680. We have a reputation for being accessible and treating our clients well. We look forward to hearing from you.
Hello, I'm Guy Terry of Terry and Peterman. At Terry and Peterman, we are committed to representing the hardworking residents of South Georgia in personal injury, criminal, and family law matters. For years, we have worked with college students in this area to ensure legal issues do not disrupt their academic careers. We also represent military families struggling with divorce and family law issues. We rely upon over 30 years of combined experience to provide aggressive representation for our clients.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Peach State Pandemonium. I'm Rich Tate. Jerry Oates will not be with us this evening, but, of course, as always, Bobby Simmons and Jay West. Bobby, how you doing tonight, sir?
Well, I'm doing well now. I just came in for a landing. I actually called in about 45 seconds ago.
Yes, you did.
it's been a hectic day. Michael's daughter came down and brought his car down here so that I can watch it and Just been a hectic day, so. But we're good. I'm glad to be here, and looking forward to you educating me tonight with some of these names I seen on the list.
And Jay, how are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm okay. Bobby, are you watching the car right now? Can you see it?
Well, it's right outside the window here. I'll hear it if it says anything.
Okay, glad to hear from you. I'm just looking for a little warm weather. I don't know about the rest of you guys. They kept promising the weekend was going to be a little bit better here earlier in the week, and now I think they're, you know, you can't depend on these weather guys, I tell you what.
Well, they said we may get some snow flurries down here tonight. It's cold enough to snow.
You're not kidding.
Where's our buddy Jerry at? Did he have a council meeting tonight?
He didn't tell me what was up. He emailed me this afternoon, just said he would not be able to make it tonight, and emailed him back, asking was everything okay. Didn't hear back, so I'm just hoping everything is okay.
Are we expecting a special appearance by Charlie Smith this evening? Do you know?
Don't we always?
Probably so. He sometimes has council meetings the first of the month, so he may be down there. I think he's going to run for political office down there. So, I think he'd be a good mayor of Tybee Island.
So would I. So would I. Send me down there.
You know, I didn't realize that he was living down there. I was looking for some information today, and I noticed that from what I saw, it was from a couple of years ago, but that's where he was located. I didn't know. That sounds like a pretty good place to spend some time.
He actually lives in Savannah. He lives in Savannah, and he commutes over to the island. You talk about falling into something. He was working out at the gym, and the sheriff down there recognized him and said, "I got just the job for you." And I'm not sure what his official title is. I think he's like the animal control officer or something. But when he told me him and another guy had to go wrestle an 8-foot alligator, I don't particularly want to do his job.
The story I was reading about that said he had wrestled some bears and during his career, and he figured based on that he was ready for whatever came his way. Bobby, just thinking about that. Bobby, did you ever work in the ring as a ref during one of the wrestling bear routines?
Oh yeah, Yeah, when we were working for Ann, there was a guy, Gene Bennett knows him. He was originally from Ohio, Gene told me, but he kind of lived around the Calhoun area. And he went by the name of Rip Tyler, but he had a bear. And the bear that he had, I mean, it was like a big puppy. I mean, you could play with it. You could. I loved to go to America's when he was there because the fairgrounds there had an 8-foot fence all the way around this huge fairgrounds. And I'd get there early, and he would turn that thing loose, man. And I'd get out there and slap it around, and it'd chase me. And, I mean, it was. I had a lot of fun with it. The only time I ever got hurt where I had to lay up and couldn't work for a couple of weeks was the bear hurt me. I got hurt when the bear hit me, but it was my own fault. But, you know, I had a lot of fun with that bear, but I've heard some horrible stories about some of those things.
Obviously, this bear was pretty well trained to do what he was supposed to do there
yes,
in the ring.
Yes,
and
yes.
Protect.
Well, you know, they're natural wrestlers. They,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
They wrestle around, roll around. This one, he would actually, you know, you could actually work with this bear. You could wrestle with it. And Jerry Blackwell pinned it one night.
Wow.
And I was, he had it down. And he looked at me and he went, count it out. I said, where's his shoulders? But, you know, the bear also, I seen him get mad one night. Ox Baker kicked it in the nose in Atlanta.
Oh, my gosh.
And it made the bear mad, and the bear sat down. And the guy told me that, you know, the guy's in the ring with a chain on a bear. He told me, he says, goose him in the butt. And he said, he's going to come after you. He said, run from him. And I did and got the bear up. But that bear, he 2 days later, we were somewhere else. And the bear was wrestling Ox again. And the bear's in the ring. And Ox come down the aisle and got in the ring. And as soon as Ox got in the ring, the bear sat down. I mean, the bear refused to do anything because, I mean, Ox tatered him good with that big clumsy foot of his. And, it was, I think it was Carrollton where the guy, he mixed up a concoction of gunpowder and honey and fed it to the bear.
Wow.
And needless to say, you didn't have any trouble getting him up that night.
High test bear.
But, yeah, it was, you know, I've heard some horrible, horrible horror stories about guys working with bears. And you know, Bob Kelly tells the story of the first time that he ever wrestled one. He said Lee Fields told him, or Bobby Fields told him, he said, what you do? He said, you let the bear kind of get down and get on top of you a little bit. And he said, what you do? He said, you take your hands and you reach up between the bear's hind legs up there and get you a double handful of that hair and pull down on it. And he said, when you pull on it, yank it pretty good. He said, that bear will get up. And he said, that bear will be afraid of you. And so Bob went for it.
Yeah.
And when he yanked on that bear, he said that bear liked to kill him.
Oh, my God, yes.
He said it liked to have killed him. Said he couldn't breathe. It was laying on him, and said Bobby was in the corner laughing, wouldn't help him. But
you know, that's something that's the kind of a lost art now. I was thinking about that. You just don't see that. I don't know if the PETA folks have.
Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals at Scream.
Right, but you know, I'd kind of forgotten about that, but I do remember seeing some of those matches when I was younger, and it just the opportunity was there, so I thought I'd ask you about it. Sorry, Rich, didn't mean to take the show away from you.
Well, let me throw one other thing in here, and Mike Norris can tell this story because he was there or he knows firsthand about it. There was one of the guys that had a bear. He had an alligator. And he was the only one that would work with it, but he would wrestle the alligator. And they had it booked in Mobile. And the alligator died.
Oh, no.
I mean, the alligator died. So he gets to the building, the alligator's dead. Michael said, this is the gospel truth if he's ever told it. The guy took a dead alligator in the ring, wrestled it, and put it over. A dead alligator. You know, I mean, I wouldn't even want to be in there with a dead one. But
no.
Still, that was, you know.
Right.
If it can be done, it's been done in this business.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
Now, Rich,
Bob,
we don't have
Bob,
any bears in the Hall of Fame, do we?
No, we don't have. No, well, I don't know. You want to give us an update on Mike real quick before we delve into the.
Michael very steadily is improving a little bit. They have moved him. He was in a room where he was getting constant care. I mean, where they were like in there all the time doing stuff to him and for him. They have moved him into a medical room now, which is just a regular hospital room. And We don't know how long he will be there because medically Michael is healing and is doing well medically. Still can't walk, still can't put any, you know, the legs still aren't working. So we really don't know where we go from here. Spencer was talking to me about that tonight, and that's all kind of up in the air. We don't know how long he'll be still be at the hospital, and we don't know where he'll go from there. But I've got to find him a rehab facility somewhere.
When you mentioned that last week, Bobby, about him not being able to walk, I was thinking about that. Is that muscle atrophy or is that paralysis?
Nobody has point blank said. I think it's atrophy. He hasn't been on his feet in 10 weeks. I mean, he's been bedridden now for 10 weeks. And 7 or 6 of those 10 weeks, he was out.
Right.
I mean, he was totally out. And his body went through tons of trauma. With the initial onset of the diabetic coma that he supposedly was in, and then he was on a ventilator for 2 or 3 weeks, and then he was had the surgery and removing intestines and colon, and just a lot of things went on. So, nobody has said. I don't think they really know, but that's my guess. He says he has tingling in his legs, and he can move his legs. I mean, his legs are not totally dead. He can move them, okay?
Right.
He just can't put any weight on him, and he can't walk on him. So I'm thinking, this is Dr. Simmons, and I don't have a medical degree. I think at some point the light's going to go on, and all of a sudden he's going to be able to start, motivating a little bit. But who knows when that is. Go ahead.
You said he had a laptop now. Is he able to get online? Is he listening to the show?
I don't know. I really don't know. He does. I didn't get out there last week, of course, with the snow and getting backed up at work and all the things I had going on with church and just different things. I didn't make it out there. I'm going Saturday. But I don't know. I know he can get online, but I don't know if he's able to hook up and hear the show or not. I haven't asked him that. I'll find out this week. But I know he can. He did have access to the room he was in. I'm not sure what he's got now, but he did have access to his email, and he was able to. He had over 900 emails when he got his computer back, so he was trying to cipher through those and see what was important and what wasn't. So he's working on it.
Mike, I guess if you are listening to us, hope you get better and get back here soon. I know a lot of people love to hear from you.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Topic for the night, continuing the Hall of Fame series, we're going to be talking about the 2005 class. Unfortunately, Jerry's not here to tell us all about how he carried bags for Al Massey. So I'll take the lead on that one. Al was actually, we kind of talked about this last week, or maybe a couple weeks ago. We were talking about Don McIntyre. It was last show. Where Don was kind of, Ray Gunkel before Ray Gunkel here, Al was kind of that guy before Don McIntyre. He first came in 1942, stayed around through part of 1943, and then in 1944 he came back and pretty much wrestled here full-time into the late 40s, and then came back after about another year, came back and wrestled through about 1952. And during that period, he was, at least before McIntyre was here, he was the lead babyface. And with McIntyre, was, still probably the top guy passing the torch to McIntyre of sorts. Going back through his record, he just main evented constantly at the City Auditorium all throughout the territory. Top guy. I've seen one match out on YouTube of him, and one day I need to throw that back up. I think we had it up as a classic clip one day. I need to pull that back out and make sure everybody catches it for today. That's about the only match I've seen. I've seen about 5 photographs maybe that are out online and available. And we're working right now, revamping the Hall of Fame section of the website, so hopefully we'll have some links to that kind of stuff up very soon. Next on the list is the Andersons, and essentially they went in as a foursome Opie, Gene, Lars, and Arn. And they pretty much, from the 60s on into the 80s, you could count on the Andersons absolutely doing some damage here. Bobby, you want to talk about them a bit?
Well, we're going to take them one at a time, or how we want to do this?
Just the different incarnations. I guess Lars and Gene first, and then...
Yeah,
I should say
as a kid... Yeah. As a kid, during the Garibaldi run here, of course, Mr. Wrestling was the top babyface, but there was a run here or a stretch here of several years where the main events were tag team matches. The Torres brothers got over here tremendously. They ran a program with the Vachons, and that kind of ran its course. And then the Andersons became the Infernos were here. There was a lot of different teams in here, but the Andersons showed up, and it was Gene and Lars. And of course, Lars was a great stick man. He could do a heck of an interview back then. And of course, Gene was a wrestling machine, and they were a great team, and they could wrestle. They did wrestle. They were not the the stomp, choke, pull hair, they would get in there and they were wrestling heels. And they were tremendous. They had a great run with the Torres brothers and several other teams that are incarnations of teams that came through here. If I'm not mistaken, the first night they were in the territory, I think I've heard Les tell this story, they booked them with Les, and I can't remember if it was Dennis or Roger. I believe it was Dennis, but they booked him with those two guys.
Yeah, I think so.
But they were supposed to put Lars and Gene over, and about 10 minutes into the match, Garibaldi, who was refereeing and also the booker, he changed it and told him to go through and brought the match back. It was that good a match.
Right.
So you would think the Andersons coming in as the top heel team would have squashed somebody, but Garibaldi was kind of on the ball when it comes to stuff like that, and he built them up slowly, but when they got there, they stayed there. They left, and the next time they showed back up, it was Ole and Gene. Again, Ole being the great interview, but Ole could also wrestle. Well, Lars could wrestle as well, but same way they got over the first time, they got over the second time with that wrestling. I mean, just beat an opponent into the ground by wrestling with him. Always breaking on the four count on tags, never middling the referee. They just absolutely would just out-wrestle their opponents. And I never had the pleasure to work with Arn. I wrote him a bunch of checks, but it was as Marty Lundy when he would come in and do Atlanta TV. But when he began teaming with Ole, it was the same thing. I mean, just Ole's influence on him, you could tell. He just became a good wrestler. And any two of them together were a great team.
Absolutely. And, Jay, I know you got some stuff on him too, but I got to say, to me, the Andersons, they were basically the Assassins without masks. I mean, they were that, they were that kind of team. They were they wrestled. They were great on the stick. Everything about them. I mean, they just to me, they're probably the two best heel teams that have ever come through Georgia.
Well, I would agree with you on that. That was going to be one of my comments that of the the early to mid '60s to the mid '70s. If you were to look at the various combinations, the two top heel tag teams of that era were the Assassins and the Anderson Brothers and their various, groupings. And Gene, old school, but as I understand it, he came up with the name Minnesota Wrecking Crew, which to me is one of the great names for a tag team. I mean, you hear that name right there and they've got something to live up to when they step into the ring. Always watching Gene, particularly on the interviews, which he was very silent, but he'd be behind Lars or Ole, and you know, they be doing their thing. And there was Gene with his various muscle tics in his face, and you know, you'd almost get lost in it. I'd forget about the interview, just trying to watch and see what Gene was going to do next. He was very good with that, and it was so natural that you didn't know sometime if it was part of the gimmick or if it was just him. But I enjoyed watching him. As I understand it, he was an excellent booker in his time. I didn't actually see the original incarnation of Gene and Lars that much. But obviously Lars came back a couple of times, but Ole and Gene, you know, they were the top heel team when I started ring announcing in 1974. And actually Ole, I believe, was in the first match when I got into the ring that Saturday morning. As I mentioned the story about Gordon talking to me about how to react to what Ole would do when he would get in the ring. But you know, I remember that quite well, and obviously they were quite a team. Bobby was mentioning about Arn, and I've said this before: the first time I saw him was working a card for Ted Allen, and before he became Arn Anderson, and Ted Allen trained him, as I understand, and I worked a show for Ted in Douglasville one night, and you know, a lot of the guys that were peripheral guys from around the area, and the guys that had left Georgia Championship Wrestling were working these independent shows. As a matter of fact, Bill Dromo worked that show that night. I believe it's the last time I ever saw him in the ring. But at any rate, in the main event was this big guy and wearing a white mask, and they were calling him the Spoiler or something. He had a manager with him, and he was excellent. And, you know, way above the other young guys or whatnot that were there that night. And I asked Ted about him, and he said, well, he's Marty Lund. I've trained him, and he's going on to bigger, better things. And, of course, it wasn't too long before he became Arn Anderson. And he had a great career. You know, he had an injury later on, but no telling what he would have done had it not been for that. Lars, I knew Lars probably of the group. I knew him the best. As I mentioned also last week, in the early 80s, he started his own TV show, the World Wrestling League, and his daughter was on there as a commentator, you know, and Ray McKay ended up his career working a little while for Lars. But he had a show, I don't know if it was on 36 or 69, I can't remember which one. But at any rate, it was on for a few months, and Kevin Sullivan was actually working with Lars behind the scenes a little bit on that show. And I did an interview with Lars and appeared in the wrestling news relating to his promotional end of the business. And so, you know, I knew him a little bit from that, and then he would came back to work for Georgia Championship Wrestling, and we had some pictures taken down in Gripping when Doug Smith was promoting there, and that was used in that article that I did. So, you know, he was probably of the bunch the one that I had the most interaction with. Funny about Ole, though, he would back behind the scenes when he would see me on Saturday, he would always call me Kid, and I thought it was funny because you know, he was a little bit older than me, but not that much. But they were, in all the different incarnations, as you said, one of the top two tag teams of that era.
All very well said. Next in the class, Bob Armstrong started here in the 60s, and, well, you probably still see him just, you know, at least once a year here somewhere. Bobby?
I met Bob in 1974. I had seen him, of course, wrestle many times, but I met him in 74. And he liked Bill Dromo. We became friends. I made some trips with him, and Bob was just he made himself into a good worker. And I think it's beyond not only is a good worker, I think he was at such a – he was at such a handicap because of his vision. Anybody that was ever around or ever watched him, it looked like he was vain. It always looked like he was looking down at his arm.
and he would flex his fingers, and he would look down. And people, you know, I've had people say, man, he must really like to look at himself. What he was doing, he was focusing his eyes. He would look at his fingers and focus his eyes. And I've often said I refereed the first Braille match because I had the privilege of refereeing Armstrong and Tom Ernesto against each other one night. But, you know, neither one could see the front row. I mean, just without their glasses. So it was but Bob was just a tremendous athlete, and he was very spry is not the right word, but he was very fluid, I guess would be the word I'm looking for. You know, Bob was a dancer. He actually performed. He actually tap danced on Stars of Tomorrow when he was a kid.
Well,
that's when Freddie first met him. But yeah, he was very fluid. That's why, you know, he could do the karate and the ollie shuffle and that sort of thing. And a lot of that come from his dancing abilities. And he just a great guy. He told me he wanted to try to make it 7 decades in the business, and I think he surpassed that. I'm not sure how old Bob actually is now, but I saw him in the ring as late as, I guess, a year and a half, 2 years ago. So he's the longevity part of him has lasted a long time. Great guy. Great guy.
Well, you know, late in his career, he was known as Bullet Bob Armstrong. And I think that came about because of the accident that he had with the weights that caused him to have the plastic surgery, which was, at the time it occurred, as I understand it, it was, you know, touch and go a little bit for a while, and he started wearing the mask after he started working again as the Bullet. But, you know, in his early career, he was called the Wrestling Fireman, and he was a fireman for Cobb County, and I think he actually worked full-time as a wrestler as a fireman up until 1970, and then he was doing so much work in the ring that he had to make a decision, and he became a wrestler full-time. He had the name Pep James in high school. He was, an athlete and well-liked. I remember when Dave Meltzer was first starting in the 80s to try to put together a listing of the real names of wrestlers, he was still listing Bob as his last name Armstrong. And I told him, no, that's not his last name. And, you know, basically it wasn't so much kayfabe anymore, but he was, you know, because he had a listing of everybody. But just to clarify, you know, I told him what his last name really was. And how I knew it was that my first wife had actually gone to high school. She was a little younger than him, but she went to the same high school she did. So that's how, in fact, I knew what his real name was. But another thing about Bob was he was a father of four young men who followed him into the business, Scott, Brad, Steve, and Brian. And that's just another legacy of the Armstrong family. The first match that I actually worked as a ring announcer before I actually went to work for Georgia Championship Wrestling, when I was working at WSSA in Morrill, Georgia, the Kiwanis Club bought some time on the station, and they were looking for somebody to announce, and I did it, and I'll never forget because Bob was in the first main event that I ever did ring announcing for in a live event. And I think I can't remember for sure. I don't know who he worked with that night. But at any rate, Eddie Smith was the referee, and that was the only time I ever worked with Eddie, was that time. And also Joyce Grable was on that card, and I mentioned that to her last year when I saw her at Nightmare to Remember. But that stood out for me that evening. And another thing about Bob, when the All-South split took place, he's remembered because in many articles he's listed as the only worker that stayed with the Paul Jones promotion, which is not true. Daryl Cochran was another one, and of course Roy Lee Welts for different reasons. But you know, Bob got some big matches because he was one of the few guys that were left around working for the Atlanta promotion that the local folks knew. And, of course, Bobby has mentioned before, that was one of the benefits that All South had was when they made when they left, they had all the talent that the local Atlanta fans knew. And so Bob got main events very quickly with Buddy Colt. I remember three Friday nights at the auditorium where they had bloodbaths. And, you know, that was, I think, that did a lot for him as far as advancing his career. The last time I saw him was last year at Nightmare to Remember 3, and I was very fortunate to be asked to make the presentation in the ring to him as the posthumous award that was made to Brad Armstrong, and it was very good to see Bob again after a long time. But he's truly one of the outstanding guys, as far as I'm concerned, in the business of that era, and it was a pleasure to be associated with him.
Yeah, Bob is a sweetheart of a guy. Bobby, would you agree
yes.
that the feud he had with Bobby Duncombe,
mm-hmm.
Just probably one of the best of that era?
Yes.
They
did the Cadillac tournament, and the finals of the Cadillac tournament was him and Duncombe. And part of the deal for him getting the Cadillac at a great price was he agreed to let Duncombe hardway him at the Omni in Atlanta. And Duncombe
and
hit
course,
him by...
And that, of course, was the debut at the Omni.
Yeah. Duncombe hit him about three times and almost knocked him out, but never opened him up. And finally, he told him, Bob's told me the story. He said he finally told him, he said, "You got one more shot, bud. I'm almost out on my feet." And he hit him the fourth time, and he opened him up. And there was a film of that. There was a 16-millimeter film at the wrestling office in Atlanta. It was the bloodiest thing I have ever seen in my life. And it was just horrible. I mean, the guys couldn't stand up. The ring was so slick. There was so much blood. And... it was just I'd love to know what happened to that piece of film, but that was just one of the, you're talking about that feud, that was sort of the climax of that feud was that match there in Atlanta. Another thing, too, that a lot of people don't know, in 1972, in November 72, when the actual split took place, a meeting was held in an Atlanta hotel on a Wednesday morning. And all the guys were invited. For whatever reason, Rock Hunter and Armstrong could not make the meeting. And that night, of course, Wednesday night, was Columbus. The only two guys that showed up in Columbus that night were Bob Armstrong and Rock Hunter. So Mr. Ward went out, made an announcement that, something had happened, the guys didn't show up, blah, 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 whatever he said. But Rock and Bob went out and worked about 45 minutes. And they said Mr. Ward paid them very handsomely.
And as I understand, he also gave the crowd their money back.
He did give the crowd their money back. He gave their money back, and he took care of those guys. I'm sure Leon probably refereed, but I don't know. But that was they were the only two guys that showed up, and they worked for Mr. Ward that night. They went in and worked because they didn't know what had happened. And then, of course, the next day when they found out what went on and why nobody showed up, Rock, of course, came with Ann, and Bob stayed with the NWA office. And it was a good career move for him, as you said, Jay. And Mr. Ward, because of Bob's loyalty, Mr. Ward treated him a lot differently than the Atlanta office did. Now, the Atlanta office used him in various scenarios and various situations, and he did do some main events in Atlanta, but everywhere he went for Mr. Ward, he was main event. Bill Dromo, same way. Bill Dromo
yes.
was main event in Columbus, Macon, Albany. Any shows that Fred ran that Bob and Bill were on, they were on top or close to the top.
And worked as a tag team in many cases.
Yeah, they were the Macon tag team champions, the Columbus tag team champions, Albany tag team champions, and in some cases they were the town champion as well, because Fred had town championships. He had an Albany champion and an America's champion, and
He used to have a little trophy that was the America's Championship trophy until Joe Hamilton won it, and he stomped it into about 1,000 pieces in the middle of the ring because it was such a disgrace to say you were the champion of America's. But anyway, it was they were treated very well. And if I can throw one thing into Jay here, you was talking a few minutes ago, and I should have said something then about Gene, about that twitch in his neck. Gene had there was a bone in his neck that was bad or whatever it was. That tick, that was not a gimmick. He could not help it. He did that. Somewhere around 1978, 79, somewhere in that neighborhood, he had surgery to replace that little bone. They took a bone out of his leg and put that bone in his neck.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused him to stop the twitch for about 6 months. And then it came back, and he said he'd never go through the surgery again. And that being said, Charlie Smith had a poster made up that somehow wound up in my possession, and I gave it to Ole a few years ago in Mobile, but Charlie had Dot Bailey over at Southern Poster print up a poster for Carrollton, Georgia. It said Mr. Wrestling 1 and Mr. Wrestling 2 versus Twitch and Bitch.
Well, I had assumed it was an injury that caused it because that's also something that a lot of the old boxers have.
Yes.
But it was used so well in the interview.
Right.
That like I said, Ole would be going nuts, I would get lost in the interview simply because I was going to wait to see counting off to see how long it was going to be before Gene would make the twitch again.
Yeah.
Let's see. Next on the list, I don't know how this guy got on here, but the second referee to be inducted, Charlie Smith.
Who?
Well, I thought that was a pretty good segue. Bobby was talking about the poster Charlie Smith had, and then we went right into it.
Yeah.
Charlie has the honor of being fired more than anybody I know. Got fired one night when he had a $5,000 house at a spot show. That's pretty good. You got to really mess up to do that. But he always showed back up. Charlie was when I first started running errands for Charlie Harbin, Charlie Smith worked in the ticket office some, and he was on the road. And Charlie was always very nice to me when I was a kid. And then when I went to work for Ann, Charlie was sort of my boss to start with there. He kind of told us he was kind of our go-between, Charlie Harbin and him. And then when Tom Ernesto approached us and wanted us to start refereeing, Charlie was kind of the guy that taught me the ropes. How I survived, I don't know. But Charlie always told me, he said, always bring your bag. He said, always bring your stuff. You never know. Even when you're not booked, bring your stuff. Well, I soon found out what that meant. He'd say, put your stuff on them and let's referee a couple of matches tonight. And if there was 5 matches on the card, he'd referee the first 3, and I'd get the last 2, and he'd be halfway to Atlanta before I got through with the last one. And then I still had to take the ring down. But
you were in the business.
I was in the business. And I look back at that, and I'm so very thankful for that because by doing that, I got to referee all sorts of matches. If you're refereeing the first match every night or the first 2 matches every night, you're probably doing a 15 or a 20-minute Broadway, and then you're doing something where, the babyface probably goes over. By doing the last 2 on these cards, whether it was a spot show or whatever it was, I was refereeing Texas death matches. I was refereeing matches where there was an angle being shot for the next time and there was some heat on the referee.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, that's something you have to learn to cope with as a referee. You have to learn to deal with the heat. Even when it's not, even when it's done the right way, there's a certain amount that's on you. And people naturally just don't like you because you got the striped shirt on. But it helped me tremendously because I learned a lot of things. And I was also blessed to be working with some of the top guys in the business and that were telling me, do this, don't do this, this is the right way, that's the wrong way. But I rode with Charlie a lot. Charlie told me things. The first trip I ever made in the wrestling business was to Savannah, Georgia with Charlie Smith. And out of all the acquaintances we meet in this stupid business of ours, I've been working for it since 1968, 69, over 40 years. And out of all the people that I come in contact with, what I consider close personal friends, you can probably count on my fingers. But Charlie Smith is one of them. I talk to him every day. He can't hear me sometimes, but I talk to him. If you want to have a real exciting time, go spend 5 days with him in Las Vegas or 5 days with him in Mobile, and the hearing aids are laying on the table between the two beds. And he's going, "What? Huh?" And you catch yourself talking to the hearing aids, saying, "Hello, testing." But he's just Charlie is a phenomenal guy, and he's a great referee. And if they're this Hall of Fame and any other Hall of Fame, he richly deserves to be in them. I mean, he's been doing this since the 50s. So if longevity counts for anything, and last Saturday was his birthday, and he was 84 years old, and he still gets around better than me.
That he does, Jay.
Charlie Smith is my oldest friend in the wrestling business, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But a lot of people don't know that Charlie had another career besides being in wrestling as a referee. He was also in the movie business. Now, he might tell you that he was, a film star, but that might be pushing it a little bit. But Charlie ran a lot of movie theaters when he was during the times that he would be fired from the wrestling business, as Bobby would mention. But that was another very successful career that he had, and he knows all about movies because he probably saw the big ones several times. But just to get him even to talk about that is very, very interesting. But I met Charlie in 1972. I had seen him, on television doing what he did. In the summer of 72, before the split, we were doing a country music show out in Clayton County at what was called Indian Lake, and had several artists that were, big during that time, and no one that anybody contemporary would remember. But at any rate, Charlie and his wife Louise and some of his family, Louise, of course, has always been a very big country music fan, and they were sitting out. It was just a lawn-type show, and during a break between when the acts were, one going off and another setting up, I saw him, and I said, I always wondered what wrestling referees do when they're not refereeing matches. I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Charlie Smith," and that's all it took. Of course, he got up and took a big bow, and when I went off stage, he came over, and we talked a little bit, and developed a friendship from that. And a couple of, when the split came along, Charlie endorsed me with Freddie Miller and Jim Bell, who had been the ring announcer and wanted to go into other things and help me get into that. And he got me a few other little gigs with some other organizations early on before I went to work for Georgia Championship Wrestling, on a regular basis. And I don't talk to him via phone often, but I think about him often, and when we do have a conversation, it's very interesting. But as far as I'm concerned, there's nobody better than Charlie Smith.
And probably one of the most photographed referees in the business.
He knew where the camera was, I can tell you that.
He never missed a photo op.
He is a huge Tarzan fan. He loves Tarzan movies. He loves old Western serials and Charlie is so varied in the things he does and the things that he likes and he's involved in. I mean, there's a lot more to him. I'll give you a couple of stories about Charlie, just funny things that happened. When Rocket Monroe, who was one of the dearest friends I ever had inside and outside this business, when he first came here, him and Flash lived in Macon. When they came in, they got an apartment in Macon, which makes a world of sense. I mean, if you look at all the towns we ran, if you're coming in off the road and you're going to get an apartment, you know, Macon was the ideal location.
Central.
I mean, it was central. You know, I mean, really, the only thing they were running north really back then was Atlanta and Athens and Cartersville on Wednesday nights and Rome wasn't running and Marietta was still running. You know, back in that day, Marietta was still running at Larry Bell up there.
Right.
Back in the day, whenever that was. But anyway, they moved there. So they did Macon TV one Thursday, and I forget where they were going that Thursday night. But Rocket's wife, Doris, loved to cook. And she told Rocket, she said, tell all the guys that I'm cooking supper or cooking lunch. Tell them all to come over here. All it can, you know, keeping kayfabe, all it can come over. So Charlie went, as a referee, Charlie went over there to eat, you know, free food. And he came in, and Charlie was being Charlie. And Doris called Rocket off to the side, and she asked him, she said, Rocket, who is that little fella in there making all that racket? And she said, that's Charlie Smith, the referee. And Doris's remark was, if he ever grows into that mouth, he'll be dangerous. But, yeah, he's all right. We were, one other little story, we were, this was on that first or second trip I made with him to Savannah. We used to stay at the Town Motel. And Charlie had a wanted poster made up with his picture on it. And it hung behind, the lady at the front desk hung it behind the desk up on the wall. It said wanted for murder, insurrection, rape, pillaging. I mean, it had all sorts of stuff he was wanted for. And we were sitting in the lobby. I'll tell you how long ago it was. We were going to see Deliverance. It had just come out. And we're sitting there waiting on it to get, you know, time to go to the movie, and we're sitting in the lobby talking. And this guy comes in to check in. And we're sitting there, and the guy walks in. He looks over where we're at, and we just kind of say, hey, how you doing? Good, good, good. And he starts checking in. Well, he looks up and sees that poster. And he cut his eyes back over where we were. And, of course, we knew what he was doing. He looked back over, and he, you know, he's seen all this dangerous stuff this guy did. He didn't want to just come out and go, that's him. So he's trying to get the lady's attention. He's going, and he's moving his finger under his nose and pointing at Charlie and pointing at the poster. And the lady finally told him, she said, yeah, we know that's him. We're afraid to turn him in. And the guy left. So, you know, it just one of the many adventures I've had with Mr. Smith.
Yeah, he, like Bobby said, Charlie's got a lot of varied interests. Another interest that he and I share is comic books of the 60s, the Silver Age, as it's called. And, of course, when I collected them, they were brand new off of the newsstand. And fortunately for me, my mother, when I went into the Army, didn't throw them out like many of the horror stories of folks who lost their baseball cards and comic books that way. But that's another interest that we share and discuss. So Charlie's a very, very interesting guy and multi-interests. And he's just, you know, he's just a joy to know. And as Bobby said, if you can, you know, make sure he's got the right equipment on to hear what you're talking about. But even if he doesn't, it's fun to talk to him. And, you know, I not a better guy.
Yep, love Charlie Smith. Next guy that was in the class, as much as he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, in his book, he basically just about took credit for the success of Ted Turner and Channel 17 and Georgia Championship Wrestling single-handedly. But, of course, I'm talking about Dusty Rhodes. There's no disputing what he did, but, you know, I'll turn it over to Bobby.
Dusty showed up on the scene when Thunderbolt came to work for Ann. That's when Dusty honed his stick for being the American Dream and the plumber's son and the whole bit and come in talking the Funky Like a Monkey tour and the whole bit. He was their answer to Thunderbolt. And he was the first guy that came in, basically that was a white guy that was talking jive. And people went nuts over him. I mean, they went crazy over him. Dusty made a lot of money. He drew a lot of good houses here in Atlanta. As far as being the reason that 17 and Turner and all those people sort of, I'm not going for that. There was a whole cast of characters that made that what that was. You couldn't single-handedly do that. You know, even Bob Hope, as popular as he was, he had to have special guests in order to make his show special. And are you saying Gordon Solie didn't have anything to do with it? Or are you saying that Freddie Miller's Be There didn't have anything to do with it? Jay West as a ring announcer didn't have anything to do with it? The guys that came in and did the jobs for the top guys every week, they were just as important as those top guys. It took all of us to make that thing what it was. Dusty was a good performer. He was a great performer. He had his spot. He had his stick, but there again, with Dusty's stick, once you saw it, you saw it. It didn't change much over the years. And I agree, he needs to be in the Hall of Fame. He's that type performer, but I totally disagree that he made Turner and made Georgia Chan. I can't agree with that. I'm not sure. Jay, what's your opinion on it? You were there.
Well, the first time I saw Dusty, he was actually working in Florida, and he came up here for a couple of shots while he was still a heel in Florida. So his first actual shots here that a lot of people don't remember, he came in as a heel, and I think there was at the Omni, Jack Briscoe was having some matches, and that was how he was introduced. And, of course, doing what he did, he went over well, but he wasn't going to get any fan support. But then when he came in the next time, he had become a babyface. And his ring style was certainly unorthodox. His interview skills, as Bobby said, were different. He was very big with the minorities that were looking for somebody to cheer for. And he became a big draw. Another thing about Dusty is that he got a lot of face time on the Aftermags. His face was there from Florida and Georgia and whatnot. You'd see Dusty Rhodes on the cover of those magazines. Now, the story's on the inside, and that's where you start believing your own hype, because the Aftermags, the pictures you saw had nothing to do with the stories that they put together on them. But, to read those things, you would think he was responsible for everything that happened. The man did become world champion a couple of times. There's not many people that did that, so you got to give him credit for that also. One thing I'll remember is that he was too big to work Griffin, but at the Sports Palace. But I remember one time, in order to get him, I guess it was a show at the Omni on Sunday night. Griffin ran on Saturday night, they decided to run a Sunday afternoon show in order to get Dusty to come in there. And he came in by helicopter. I mean, if you want to talk about somebody like you're the governor or somebody else coming in, the helicopter landed, Dusty got off the thing, came in, worked his match, then left there and went to Atlanta and worked that night. So at some point you got to believe your own hype. And if you're playing the part and you're getting over that way, then I guess it's easy to think you can take credit for everything, and I'm sure there's some fans that would agree with that. He was big, and he was good at what he did. I would see him behind the scenes sometime, and he could actually take that persona off, which was good because some guys couldn't. You know that, right, Bobby? He could take it off. And,
yeah, he like so many of them were so likable and so fun to be around when they could take it off. You know, I mean, I've made this statement openly a lot of times. Alan Rogowski is the nicest guy I've ever met in my life. He is fun to be around. He is fun to talk to. He is a great guy. But you got to get by Ole to get to Alan, and it's not easy to do.
Right. I never got close enough to Al to do that, but at any rate, yes, I'm certainly aware of that. But at any rate, with Dusty, you know, he drew, and that's you know what it's all about. I got to give the man credit, but certainly it was not a under any circumstances whatsoever. It was at no time was it ever a one man show.
No.
I will say this. I loved him feuding with Ole Anderson. In whatever tag team situation they had going on or singles matches, that was always just great stuff because you never knew what was going to fly out of their mouths when they were doing a promo or an interview, and just the matches were always incredible. And Bobby, there's a story you told me one time off the air. I don't know if you told it here on the show before, but I think it was maybe you that had to pick him up at the airport.
Yeah, I told it a couple. I have told it, but yeah, Dusty, Ole and Ivan were the tag champions, and Dusty was wrestling every week. Dusty was getting a partner, and they were getting beat every week. It was a different partner, and this went on for about 5 or 6 weeks, and finally, Dusty asked Stan Hansen to be his partner. And, you know, here again, oh, he's going to turn on you, you know. He was Ole's partner, blah, 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 blah. This was a run when Stan was babyfacing, or when they turned him. So the deal was, Jay, you were probably doing the ring announcing. I don't remember. But when we went out, when he didn't show up, and you went out and made the announcement, he hadn't showed up, and if anybody wanted their money, they need to go get it now.
Yep.
We did that at 8:30, and then went back out at the first intermission, told him again. He still hadn't showed up. We don't know where he's at, blah, blah, blah. Well, I picked him up at the airport about 9 o'clock, and we brought him back downtown, and we parked in the lot across the street from the big side entrance there. And the deal was he's supposed to hit the door at 10 minutes after 10 and hit the ring. The guys are going to go in the ring a little bit before 10, and Ivan and Ole are just going to be wearing Hansen out. And, you know, Hansen's going to be – you know, he's let me down and blah, 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 the whole bit. So, I picked him up and we took him back over and we got over in the dark over in the parking lot across the street, and we ripped his pants up and we tore his shirt up and he gigged himself and he had the blood coming pretty good and he cut his arm. His arm was bleeding. I mean, he was doing good. And we got out and it was almost 10 after 10 and we stood outside and he said, "How do I look?" I said, "You look good." And there was a mud puddle there. And he thought, "Well, I'm going to roll in the mud." And I said, "Well, you know, whatever you want to do." So he got out and he rolled in the mud a little bit. And when he got up, we heard somebody laughing. And we looked up, and there's a balcony up behind the fire department headquarters there for the city of Atlanta. And there's about 10 firemen standing up there watching us do the whole thing. So he said, "Oh, well." But he hit the door at 10 after 10. Of course, the place went crazy. And to the best of my knowledge, nobody asked for their money back that night. I don't think one soul asked for their money back. Jay announced 2 or 3 times that he wasn't there. And if you wanted your money back, go get it, you know. But, that was one of those things that we pulled off. That and another time we did this was with Thunderbolt, but I don't know if you remember, Ole took one of the hubcaps off of his, they took a hubcap off his Cadillac.
Yep.
And beat it up with a ball bat or something. I forget what they did, but I remember the office had to buy a new hubcap to replace the one we beat up, and it was something like $600 or something. The feud with Dusty and Ole you were talking about, that's one of the things, Jay and Rich, that's one of those things where people that sit on the front row in Atlanta, and I can see faces, but I can't call names, and I guess I probably wouldn't if I could, but they're the ones that would always come up to you and go, "You know, I know this stuff's fixed. I know there ain't nothing to it. I know they're not really hitting each other. But, you know, I was there the night Dusty and Ole really got mad at each other."
This was
the one that they always – it was always those two guys that they told us. And if I've heard it once, I've heard it 1,000 times. And to the best of my knowledge, I was in the ring with those two guys hundreds of times, I imagine. And I never – have heard those two guys have a crossword with each other. They were one of those, you know, I mean, the closest we ever come to having a riot in Atlanta was the night in that cage when Ole turned on him.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean, that was just, you know, we fought our way out of the – I was outside that cage, but we fought our way to the dressing room. I mean, it was horrible. But it was just a you know, those two guys just work well together. It was sort of like Ray Gunkel and Freddie Blassie, same kind of deal. Those guys got along fairly well, and they made tons of money because they just worked well together, and people thought they was killing each other.
Yeah, and, you know, that another funny thing about that is that if you think about it, really and truly, a lot of guys that tag-teamed together hated each other more than guys that were working against somebody.
Rocky, there was about 90% of the time Rocky couldn't stand Flash.
Well, that was the story about George Scott and his brother Sandy. You know,
yeah.
It went much further than a dislike.
Yeah, they went years and never spoke. When Sandy died, George didn't go to the funeral.
Right, and you know, this is just things that you know, people talk about the heel and the baby face and how they really hated each other. But if they knew what would, you know, it was a lot better stories going on behind the scenes than what was happening out there in the ring.
Oh
sometimes.
Yeah.
All right, and after Dusty, the next up to discuss is the original Gorgeous George. More of a performer that came in for one shots here and there. At one point did win the Southern Heavyweight title, Georgia version of it. He was in here in the 40s all the way up into 1960, actually, on and off making appearances, and actually wrestled under his real name, George Wagner, back in the 30s here. A little bit, and not to be mistaken, of course, with the, the other two Gorgeous Georges that worked here, and then Gorgeous George Jr. and Gorgeous George the Third. But I guess the second most known would have been George Grant. He made a lot of regular appearances in here around the same time as Gorgeous George Wagner. But it's Wagner, of course, that got inducted. One of the first, stars of the TV generation, really. Pretty much anywhere he would go, he would be popping houses, right?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, he was the thing that got people over in the wrestling business, no matter how good a wrestler you were, was your gimmick. And he was totally unique. I mean, he was totally unique, and he played it to the hilt. And I've heard guys say that, you know, I've heard some guys say he was a pretty good wrestler, and I've heard, but most of the guys that I've heard talk about him or tell me about him say that he was just the absolute best performer for working a gimmick that they had ever seen. They said that. And I don't know how true this is, but I've heard more than one guy tell me this. They said he made over $1 million doing the gimmick. But when he died in California, he died broke.
Yeah.
Which is like a lot of the guys.
Yeah, that's not unique, you know.
No.
And
no.
I actually can remember him from the early 50s. Even though, as Rich said, he wrestled much, much later than that, but when he was, still a big star. But probably if he hadn't been there, there wouldn't have been a Dusty Rhodes. There wouldn't have been a Hulk Hogan. Probably if you're thinking about the era that we worked in, I would say maybe Terry Garvin was the closest to somebody that had an act similar to his. But the thing about George Wagner, Gorgeous George, is that he was the one that got a lot of mainline coverage in the early days, in the late 40s, the early 50s, and when other guys wouldn't. And he would appear on the big TV shows. He was on Milton Berle's show with Bob Hope, you know, a lot of these things. So, wrestling was a mainstay in the early 50s on network television, on the old DuMont network. And so he was well known by the masses, he was very flamboyant, his character. I think he started out, from what I've read, as a carnival wrestler, and he developed his glamour boy gimmick in 1941, and with the platinum blonde hair and the valet and spraying the Chanel No. 5 in the ring. And he used it for all it was worth. and he made the money, and obviously he spent the money. But Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, has said in interviews that, you know, he copied his persona off of what he remembered from Gorgeous George. So he influenced a lot of people later on and helped revive the wrestling business in the early 50s.
Yeah, Dick Steinborn's told a lot of great stories about him over the years, and one of which was trying to remember which town it was, he said, but apparently there was some small town in Georgia, and I'm guessing since Steinborn was there, it had to be the late 50s, early 60s, but or 1960. But apparently, I guess, you know, he came in with pomp and circumstance, and something like the, you know, this building was big enough to hold, you know, a few hundred people, and apparently there were only about three dozen people there or something like that. And, you know, I guess you would expect a lot more than that for any wrestling promotion, especially one as large as the Georgia Territory, especially when you got a Gorgeous George on it. But it may go to, I guess, speak toward, you know, the end of his career.
Right.
Let's face it, you know, the novelty's kind of worn off. But he still went out there and put on the same show he would always put on as if he were at Madison Square Garden. To me, that just says, you know, he may have been a wreck in real life, but he was a professional in the ring.
Well, you know, it's you know, once again, the music business, same story. There may only be 10 or 20 people in the audience, but those people paid to see a show, you know.
Yep.
And that's what a professional is all about, knowing that it's not the size of the audience. It's the fact that they're there to see you do what you're going to do. And that's to me, is the, you know, the occasion of what a professional is.
Well, Joe Hamilton told me something one time, and I've always remembered it. He told me, he said, you know, we worked somewhere one night, not many people there, and after the show was over, I was riding with him, we're coming home, and he said, I want to talk to you about something. And I said, all right. He said, you didn't work very hard tonight. And I said, okay. He said, you worked hard. He said, but you worked slower. He said, you didn't give it your all. And I said, okay, I didn't really pay any attention. And he said, well, he said, you're letting the size of the crowd influence how you work. He said, you got to remember something. He said, if with that few people that we had in that building tonight, there are our truest and our best friends, because we evidently didn't have anything that the people wanted, that were willing to pay to come see. He said, but these people showed up anyway. He said, so they're the best fans we got. We should work harder for them than we do when we have a house full. So that always stuck with me, and I always tried to remember that.
And Lord knows I came across that as a musician a million times. There's nothing worse than hitting a town, nobody knows who you are, and, you know, there's 10 people there, and then you go back the next time. If you bust your ass, you go back next time, there's more.
Yeah.
Next on the list, this guy was hugely important to Georgia, mostly behind the scenes, Jim Barnett.
Who? Oh.
Jim Barnett.
James E.
Yeah.
There's a million stories out there. Probably over 900,000 of them are true. Jim Barnett hired me when Ann Gunkel closed down business. We ended our run in November of 1974 in Montezuma, Georgia, Dick Steinborn town. That was our last show. They held a meeting at the office on Saturday morning that I was told to stay away from. And I couldn't stand it. I went. And when I went in the door, Harbin went, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I said, Charlie, I need to know what's going on. I said, this is crazy. I said, I need to look for a job. And Barnett was there, and Barnett said, is this Bobby? And Charlie said, yeah. And he said, come in here. And he went in there, and he told me, he says, I'm looking for someone to referee, haul the ring, make repairs to the ring. Is that something you do? And I said, that's what I've been doing for 2 years. He says, be at my office at 9 o'clock Monday morning to meet the booker. You have a job. So out of 31, 32 guys on a roster for Gunkel, when we closed down, I was the only one that walked out of there on Saturday morning and went to work for Georgia Championship Wrestling on Monday morning at 9 o'clock. He immediately, when I walked in, when and I'm not bashful about this. It's the truth. Ann paid me $175 a week. Paid all my expenses because I was driving a ring truck doing whatever. I didn't ever have to buy any gas or, you know, if I stayed over, she paid for the hotel. I mean, that was the deal. When I went over to Barnett's, when I went over that Monday morning, the first thing he asked me was, he said, how much money was you making? And I said, $175 a week plus expenses because I was driving the truck. And he said, well, I'll pay your expenses over here as well. He said, but that's not enough money. He said, effective today, you make $350 a week. And he wrote me a check that morning. I hadn't worked it. I hadn't worked none for him, and he paid me that day. And 2 weeks later, he upped it to $500 a week. I mean, just he was that good to me. I refereed, put the ring up, worked around the office, did whatever I needed to do or whatever was asked to do. And then when Doug Smith decided that he was tired of, he wanted to go into construction business with his dad, he left. And Barnett asked me if I could do the payroll that Monday morning until he could hire someone to come in and do it. And I did it that Monday morning. And when I got through and got everything done, he called me back in the office. He says, I didn't know you knew how to do all this. I said, well, you've never given me a chance. And he said, well, I don't need to hire anybody. He says, you can do this. He says, would you like to be the office manager? And I said, well, you know, whatever you want me to do. So that's when I pretty much quit refereeing and started working in the office. And of course, he paid me a flat salary every week, plus the NWA paid me a little bit every week to take care of their books. And I worked for the man until I quit in 1983. He was a very private individual. He was very smart when it come to dealing with people and knowing things that would work in the wrestling business and things that wouldn't. Ole had full control. He gave Ole full control of the wrestling end of it. But every once in a while, Jim would have an idea or he would throw something out on the table. And anytime he tried anything, it worked. Tommy Rich was a Barnett invention. He seen him, knew what he could do with that, what a booker could do with that, and he left the TV station and called Nick Gulas and cut a deal to get him down here, and, of course, the rest was Tommy's history.
Including 1 week as the NWA champion.
Yes, and that was Barnett's idea as well.
Yep.
He had a great mind for the wrestling business. His personal lifestyle never came into play with me. It never came into play as far as the wrestling was concerned. It was his life was totally different from his business. He was very big politically in the background. He supported candidates financially. He supported candidates with his ability to influence different people in different arenas. Jimmy Carter put him on the Democratic National Finance Committee there for a term. He was appointed by Jimmy Carter to the National Endowment of the Arts. If you ever see a picture of Jimmy Carter's inauguration where they show the full picture and you can see the crowd behind him sitting up on the platform at the Capitol, if you look up about four rows, you'll see Bob Hope sitting on the left side of the aisle. The person in front of him is Jim Barnett. I mean, that's how much clout he had. I say it was Jim Barnett. It was either Jim Oates or Jim Barnett. Jim might be on the inside. I'm not sure. But he's on the row in front of Bob Hope. He just knew, from a business standpoint, he knew how to do things. He knew how to get things done. A lot of people didn't agree with the way he did business, Ole being one of them. History will always tell the truth that as long as Barnett ran Georgia Championship Wrestling, it was successful and it made money. And after it was taken over by other parties, it lasted for 2-3 years and then was gone. So we'll just leave that at that. He was falsely accused of many things. He was sued several times for things that he didn't do. I don't believe he did. He told me he didn't do them. I believed him. I didn't have any reason not to believe him. But he was so private, he would settle a lawsuit out of court because he didn't want to get his name dragged through the mud or his life or whatever else. And that was to his part of his downfall, I guess. When he left here, he went to work for Vince, and he worked for Vince for a while, and then he wound up back in Atlanta. And Vince paid him a salary till he died. I talked to Jim on a Friday, or I actually talked to him on a Thursday, and we had made plans to go to lunch the following week. I was going to pick him up, and we were going to go eat lunch somewhere. I hadn't seen him in a while. And he fell that Friday and broke his arm, and they put him in the hospital, and he developed pneumonia, and he died over the weekend. So kind of an anticlimactic way to go out for all of the things he did in this business, but Jim Barnett was he was good to me. He was good to my family. He kept food on our table for a whole lot of years, and we remained friends till he died.
Story about, since Bobby had mentioned Doug Smith there briefly, when Doug was the office manager, Doug knew that I was a musician because occasionally I'd ask Freddie to, you know, I needed to be off because I had a music gig that was going to pay me more than what the wrestling thing was, so Freddie'd work. So anyway, Doug called me one morning, and he said, Mr. Barnett wants to buy a guitar for a friend of his. I said, okay. He said, I need you to tell me what we need to get and how much. He said, money is no object. I said, well, when you buy a guitar, you're looking at more than just money. I said, what kind of guitar are you looking for? He said, just one that's, that the friend's going to like. I said, great, Doug, you've given me all the information I need. But at any rate, we settled on an acoustic guitar, a Gibson, that was very nice from the music store that I did business with, and got him a good price on it. But it was just one of the little things that I remember because Doug had asked me to do that, and it was specifically for Mr. Barnett. Jim actually, you know, didn't have conversations with me. He knew who I was, and I knew who he was. There was one time where they worked a program where he had to, at the Omni, come down and sit next to me for a series of matches that were taking place, and he was going to be involved in something relating to that. So we carried on a little pretend conversation a little bit. But other than that, we never had any conversations except after the fact when, you know, he was out of the business per se, and Bobby was talking about the lawsuits. With Jim Wilson's antitrust case, I was called as a witness in the mid-80s, I'm sorry. And of course, Mr. Barnett was involved in that antitrust case. And so his lawyer came over and pre-interviewed me, Mr. Barnett's lawyer. And then right before I was to go into the courtroom, Mr. Barnett came up to me, and he said, you worked for me as an announcer at one point, didn't you? And I said, yes, sir. And that was the last conversation I had with him. And 5 minutes later, they made an agreement, and the case never went to court. I don't think it specifically had anything to do with what I had to say to him, but he knew that I had no real interest in the case other than just whatever they were going to ask me as to what I knew, and I was not trying to get anything out of it. But the man was a legend when it came to behind-the-scenes work in the wrestling business, and as Bobby mentioned, he had a lot of political influence, and he knew the right people. And what more can you say than that?
Yeah, he came in, and I want to say, it's October 73, I believe, when Lester Welch, I believe, was being bought out. He bought out Lester and Roy's shares in the company, and he ended up, I guess, Bobby, I don't know if you can add much to this or not, about what was going on behind the scenes, but that was, you know, right in the middle of the war that had started, you know, just in November of the previous year, and of course, All South goes on for another 12, 13 months from there, but as I understand it, I guess he kind of brokered a deal to get Ann to close the doors and paid her handsomely, I guess, for many years.
I was still writing. When I took over as office manager in 79? I don't even remember when I started back there for him. We were still writing checks once a month. I mean, I wrote the last check. When the deal finally ran out, I wrote the last check and delivered it. But it was it was paid through a law firm downtown, but yeah, I'm not sure what the deal was, but yeah, they were paid for years and years and years. You know, Jim was, I don't know, I can't say enough about the man. I know he had his faults, and he didn't get along with everybody and everybody, you know, but he was just, I've seen him help so many people, and part of the deal with helping him was don't tell them where it come from. I mean, he's paid guys, he's gave them money, he's paid their rent, I've seen him do so much. And I feel like the guy got a bad rap on a lot of fronts, and you know, he's not here to defend himself anymore, and he probably wouldn't even if he could. But again, he was just so very good to my family, and I sure am glad I got to work for him and get to know him a little bit. I mean, he was the only guy I ever knew that owned a Rolls Royce was Mink on the floorboard.
Another guy, you talk about him getting a bad rap, another guy that gets a bad rap, and you know, we've talked about this before, and I'd kind of like to just sort of get it out here and get it over with, you know, about Tommy Rich's title reign and how he supposedly came about it. You know, there's enough people out there that hear this show that know the rumors, but I'd love for you to be able to put that to rest here.
The Booker at the time, I after going back and talking to different people, and me and Jerry talked about this one night. The Booker at the time that went down was Buck Robley. It wasn't, I thought it was Ole, but it was Buck Robley. Barnett brokered the deal to get Tommy the belt for a week. He actually didn't have it a whole week. He had it 5 days. He was never on Atlanta TV with it. He was never on... I don't think he ever made a TV with it. I know he didn't, because we didn't run any TVs during the week back then.
He did do one interview that ended up showing on the Sunday Best Of show, but it was just a little 5-minute thing.
Okay. Well, the only people that knew about it were the board of directors, because Barnett approached the board of directors. Tommy did not know about it. Tommy had no clue. When he got to Augusta, Georgia that Monday night, he had no clue he was going to win that belt that night. Buck Robley knew it. Harley knew it. I was told about it on Monday afternoon. The only reason I knew about it was if you ever were a wrestling fan and you bought a program at any arena in the country, when the title changed hands, there was always a copy of a telegram in the programs stating, Tommy Rich defeats Harley Race in Augusta, Georgia, stop, time of match, blah, 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 stop, blah, 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 and whatever it said. Well, those were legitimate. Those were shoots. As soon as the match was over in Augusta, as soon as the title switched, they called Barnett, and Barnett called me. I was sitting at home waiting on him to call. As soon as he called, I got on the phone with Western Union, and I sent that same telegram to every NWA office in the world. Barnett's thinking on it was, and this was something that was talked about after the fact, because nobody really knew why he did it, but the thing was done. They were trying to give Tommy some legitimacy,
mm-hmm,
as being a top babyface contender for the title. That was all it was for. That was the only reason it was done. The title switched hands in Augusta, Georgia, in a building that'll hold 3,500 people. Now, I don't know if it was sold out that night or not. It probably was. It sold out almost every week or came real close. He worked in Macon on Tuesday. Nobody knew he was a champion until he got to Macon. He worked Columbus Wednesday. Nobody knew he was a champion until he got to Columbus. He worked either Athens or Rome on Thursday. Nobody knew he was the champion. And then on Friday night, we ran a spot show in Gainesville, Georgia, at the Gainesville Civic Center. And if it was packed, it'll hold 600-700 people. And that's where he switched the title back to Harley. So the whole thing was done as low-key as possible, other than, you know, announcing to the world that he won it and held it for 5 days. I'm not sure it did his career a whole lot of good, or, I mean, it couldn't. People say it hurt it. I don't think it hurt it, but it, you know, at the time the title was very, it meant something, and he was one of the few people that could have his name on that list.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know, that's the whole thing. That's the whole reason he got it. That's the whole thing about it. Barnett did not, as much clout as Jim Barnett had with the NWA, he did not have the clout to change that title just on his word. It had to be approved by the board of directors because Jim was so adamant to do things the right way when it came to that sort of stuff. It would never have entered his mind to approach Harley and say, this is what I want to do, without the board knowing about it.
And wasn't there some kind of workaround on the deposit for the belt?
Well,
didn't somebody else put that up or whatever?
Barnett stood for it. They never put the money up. Barnett stood for it because, see, the money was put into an escrow account. Harley's money was in the escrow account. So,
right.
You know, if you had done it by the letter of the law, you would have had to have cut a check for the $25,000 plus whatever interest it had accrued and give it to Harley if you had done it by the letter of the law. But then Friday night, Harley would have had to turn right around and gave the $25,000 back as the bond for the belt. And his appearance, this was an appearance bond, is what it was, more so than the belt. But it was just, it would have been a, it would, number one, it would have been a nightmare to try to do it. And number two, think about the tax implications Harley would have faced, pulling out $25,000, taking the interest off of it, then putting it right back in. So the money never came out of the escrow account. So the money never actually, the money was, in essence, the money was still there, even though it switched from the title changed hands, but Barnett stood good for it. That's the way that worked. Because I know the night that Dusty won the title in Atlanta from Harley, Harley was given the check for $25,000 plus the interest that was given to him in a cashier's check in the office before the match ever took place. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, but that's the way that worked. It was, I mean, when I started seeing all the things in print and the rumors and the things, you know, that's people got nothing else better to do. And that stuff's, what I just told you is the absolute truth as to what happened. And whether they believe me or not, that's their prerogative. But that's exactly what happened.
Well, it makes sense. It was an enhancement opportunity, as you said, for Tommy Rich. It could help the promotion. And, you know, it makes sense that that's why it was done. I don't think it hurts Tommy's career. And, you know, he was promoted as such later on. There were a couple of very quickie-type title changes that took place a couple of times where, you know, outside of that promotion, it was not known that the title changed hands. That would not have been possible today with the Internet and everything that we have to keep something like that a secret. But I do know between that title that Monday and what you said that Friday on television that next day on Saturday, Gordon did mention, and he started off by saying Tommy Rich won the title on Monday night, and the little girls went crazy in the studio when he said that, and then next sentence was, unfortunately, he lost it last night, wherever, you know, as you said, wherever that Gainesville, wherever the title match took place. So it was announced, and I don't think that there was, you know, anything other than trying to do business. That's what it's all about.
That's all it was. That's all it was.
Well, I think there's been far worse things to hurt his career than a five-day title reign. The most prestigious title in the business.
Well, you were talking about the title changed hands. I know Briscoe, Baba approached Briscoe in Japan, and he gave Briscoe $10,000 to drop it to him for a week.
Right.
Yep.
And Muchnick was still the president. You know, Muchnick was booking the champion, and Muchnick never knew anything about it.
It finally got to the magazines.
Oh, yeah.
But
long time after the fact.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember the last time I saw Jack in Vegas, we were talking. I mean, one of the things that we were just one of those general sessions where you're talking about all sorts of things. And he knew that I worked for Barnett when Barnett was booking, you know, he booked Harley and he booked Ric Flair and Terry Funk. And I would, you know, a lot of times I'd type up the booking sheet, or Louise Bennett would type up the booking sheet or whatever. And we were talking, and the question came up. It said, well, Jack, you know, what happens if he wouldn't give the title back? And he said, well, he said that was never an issue. He said he was either going to give it back or I was going to take it. He said that was never the thing. He said my thing was, how was I going to get 10 grand cash out of that country without having to pay taxes on it? So, you know, back in the day, they weren't, you know, the screenings weren't quite as well. He said he had money stuffed everywhere when he got on that plane, but you know, that was just one of the things. But that, yeah, it did. There was a couple of times it did it that not a lot of people knew about.
And that was the way it was then. As I said, you could get away with something like that now.
Yeah, you couldn't now. No, you can't. That's why the days that we had will never come back. You couldn't run a territory anymore.
Right.
Next on the list, Mario Galinto. Bobby?
Never worked with him. Saw him many times as a kid. Was afraid of him. He was a big heel here. Had a great feud with Buddy Fuller. Here later on switched to babyface and had a good run with Butcher Vachon and Hangman Hole versus Hangman Hole, but all of that was as a kid. You know, I never had a chance to work with him. Never met him. Michael Norris actually got the chance to meet him and was on a couple of cards with him, but I can just remember he came in here and he had that long hair and he had an earring, and this was way ahead of when that was, you know, very stylish. He was way ahead of the curve. And, he was a big heel here. And as a kid, man, I was afraid of him.
Other than TV, I never saw him work. As Bobby said, he, you know, I saw pictures of him, and he was a very scary-looking guy, legitimately. And, you know, he worked other areas. But during the time that he was probably the hottest here, I guess, which was in the mid-60s, at that time, as a fan, I was unfortunately not here. I was in the Army. And so probably when he was having his hot matches in the Atlanta area, I wasn't here to see him. But I've heard a lot of people talk about him, and Charlie Smith has got some pretty good stories about him. I think he went into the restaurant business after he got out of the wrestling business.
Had a pizza place. Sure,
yeah.
Did.
And he, as I understand it, lived a pretty long life. But he was kind of before his time, as Bobby said. And, you know, he was, as far as his looks was concerned, he was the perfect heel. And people were scared of him, but I think he drew. You know,
they worked an angle in Rome, Georgia, where Mario Galinto wrestled the referee, Charlie Smith, and Charlie had on a pair of long tights, you know, all the way down, you know, from his feet all the way up, you know, Charlie's a heavyweight now compared to what he was. You know, he was skinny back then.
Oh, yeah.
So they went out to work their match, and Mario told him, he said, hit me with the brass knucks. So Charlie had a pair of brass knucks in his trunks, and he pulled them out and he hit him with it, and the people went crazy. Charlie stuck them back in his trunks. So they locked up again. Mario said, hit me with them again. And Charlie says, I can't. He said, why? He said, when I put them in my trunks, he said, they went all the way to my shoe.
Hit me with your shoe.
Yes. And if I'm not mistaken, it was Bill Dromo and Mario Galinto wrestling each other in Holly Springs, Georgia, when Charlie was fussing at Bill Dromo and he spit his false teeth out.
Oh, wow.
And Dromo caught him and didn't want to give him back. But, yeah, that's a couple of Mario stories. There's a lot of stories of Mario around that we need to get Joe Turner back on the air. He can tell us some Mario stories, because I think Mario's wife, Smokey, who I have met and we've had on this show, she was more dangerous than he was, because she would sit in the crowd with a gun. And when there would be a lot of heat or a lot of trouble, she's the one that welded the gun around.
Danny Goddard has been helping us put together some stuff for the Hall of Fame portion of the website, and just writing about Mario in here. He talks about the feud that he had with Sputnik, and then Buddy Fuller, the Medics, Freddie Blassie. Just talking about Blassie, where they were brutal barbed wire matches.
Barbed wire match I ever seen was him and Blassie.
Yeah. And that's way before extreme wrestling.
Yes.
So the pizza arena, that was in was that in Marietta?
Lilburn.
Lilburn. Okay. And I've got a note in our stuff here. It says that there was an ad in the December 23, 1966 program for the city auditorium. There was an ad in that program for Galento's Pizza Arena Restaurant, where the highest priced item was a 16-ounce T-bone steak for
$3.25. Hey, hey.
Can't beat it. I wonder if it's still there.
Yeah, exactly.
I was looking at the this is just totally going off the grid here. I was looking at there's a website, and I can't remember what it's called, but it's like it shows different pictures of Atlanta every day, or back from in the day or whatever. And they run a lot of ads about these clubs that used to be downtown Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a club today, and I can't remember. It said it was across the street from the Lowe's Grand Theater, and I can't remember the name of it, but it had exotic dancers and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, it showed the menu, and it had like a Kansas City strip steak for $2.25 or something. I thought, man.
Are you talking about the AtlantaTimeMachine.com?
Yes, that's it. That's it.
I love that site. Yeah, I love that site.
Yeah, what a great site, man. I love going through there looking around. And one of the things they plug right on their front page is Freddie Blassie's old house.
Yeah, it's a nice place to go when you're not at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Yes.
Had to get the plug in there. And last but not least on the list, if I could get that back up, Tom Ernesto, and of course this is mostly for his work behind the scenes. Bobby?
He was the first booker I ever worked for. He was... had a brilliant mind for the wrestling business. He was a great booker. We referred to him as Old Silver Tongue. He could talk you into being sick. He could talk you into feeling good. He could look at you in the eye and lie to you, and you'd know he's lying, and you'd still want to believe him. Just a great all-around guy. Matter of fact, like I say, my son is named for him and Jody. I had the greatest respect for these two guys. I was so privileged and honored to be able to work with them and call them my friend. And Tom had a great run here. He had a great run in Florida. He worked for Nick Gulas for a while and got that territory up some. I think if I'm not mistaken, his last run as a booker was working for the Sheik. And that's probably a lot of people's last run, but I had the privilege of, he came to our reunion in Mobile the year that he died. He was there in March, and I had the privilege of spending a couple hours with him on a Saturday night, just me and him. And it's the first time that we ever talked as friends and not as him talking to a kid. We had a long conversation about a lot of different things, and I'll treasure that till I'm gone. But Tom was a great guy. I don't know what to say about him. His wife Kathy and his sons Tommy and Timmy, they're just I love them all, and they're like family to me. And I miss Tom. I wish he was still around. So I could bend his ear when I need to talk about things. But great guy.
There's a YouTube video on him when he, sometime after he left Atlanta, he worked in Memphis and Mid-South as a manager there, and I think he was probably the booker there for a while too. But that was one of the last pieces of footage that I saw on him we've talked about the fact that one of the biggest, you know, jaw droppers was when he unmasked on television. I'll never forget that. But as a booker, I think he you know, didn't get the credit he deserved. I think he was an excellent booker. He always was respectful of me, as I had mentioned. But I just have to mention his interviews while he was still active as a competitor, both as a wrestler and as a manager. The controlled, articulate interview that he did for matches that was so totally different from what was normally considered the heel type interview. It was, you know, it just seemed so real. And he was really great for getting that over. And when Tom Ernesto said something about giving no quarter or what was going to take place at the Atlanta City Auditorium, he said it in such a way that you believed it. And he was excellent at that. I don't think that there was anything that he did either behind the scenes or in the ring that was less than what you'd expect out of a top-notch guy.
All right, guys, we've got a special guest here calling in. Looks like he wants to get on the line with us here, so we're gonna bring him up. Joe Turner. Joe, how you doing tonight?
Well, I'm doing great, man. I'm enjoying the show tonight. And it's talking about Mario Glinto and Ernesto, and Ernesto is, he was a very talented person. And Mario Glinto was one of the stories I'll always remember. His wife was sitting out in the audience, and I left him in the ring. He'd been so many hard ways that when I busted his head open, it didn't even bleed. And but he's laying in the ring, and I'm here for the dressing room. And when I walked between the ringside, his wife stepped up there and she put a chrome plated 38 up to my head.
Whoa.
He said, "Don't you move, SOB." I said, "Don't worry, ma'am. I don't have nowhere to go." He didn't ever let his wife know too much about what his business was in that ring. I mean, he would sell the business to them. You know, he just, that's the way he was. But his wife, she come to, I was working at that flea market in Pensacola, Florida, and she come by, and my kids had stuck a wrestling tag thing on the back of bumper, a bumper sticker.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't get it off, so I just left it on there. And it's sitting behind my boot where I was selling stuff. And she comes there, she says, "Whose truck is that back there?" I said, "What do you mean, whose truck it is?" "It's got something about wrestling on it. I just want to know whose truck it is." I said, "Well, I think it belongs to a guy that she pulled a pistol on it up in North Alabama." She stared at me for a little bit. She said, "Oh, you're Joe."
When you said pull the gun on you, that narrowed the list down to probably about 25 people.
Yep.
Yeah. I tell you about Mario one time. He wasn't getting along too good with Dick Dunn then. And we had a deal in Dothan, Alabama, where we put Dr. Jerry Graham in a cage. Well, Mario worked his way in on that deal. He went up there and just walked out on the TV on his own and told him, he said, "Yeah, and he won't get out of that cage either because I'm going to be standing over with a baseball bat." Well, he got himself in that deal. And so our manager there, Graham, he had a thing like a Tarzan suit on. Well, he took a wire clothes hanger and put down in it. And old Mario come over and hit that cage every time he put his hands up there or whatever. And then Mario turned around and watched a match. Well, whenever he turned around and watched the match, he took that wire hanger out and stuck it through between them bars and hooked him around the neck and like to choke him to death. And he said there was it was the wind cut off. Dick Dunn was going to run around there to save you and see what was going on. He just started walking. But he was something in his day. He's one of the hottest things around Mobile, Alabama there for years. So, anyway, you know, his daughter wrestled also. She lasted for quite a while.
Now her name was Barbara, right?
It what?
Was it Barbara?
Yeah, it sure
Barbara
was.
Galento, yeah.
Yeah, she used to come to match with him when she was young. Then she started wrestling. Yeah, he got me to ride with him when I was younger. So he got me to ride with him one night at Key Foot Company. He got in that parking lot, everybody's gone, and I thought he could turn that car over. I was wanting to get out as fast as I got in there. So I was scared to talk to her anyhow because I didn't know whether he'd like it. So, you know, he did have that persona about him. He made a movie one time, and everybody in Mobile went out to drive in the movie to see it. And it had a big sign up there, a billboard out front. Starring Mario Galento. And I went out there and sat to watch that movie, and I sat there through the whole thing. At the end of it, they showed him riding in on a horse and buggy in the tank. And that's it.
Starring Mario Galento. There you go.
No, that's the only people that named on there. Didn't he name anybody else on that billboard? It just says, starring Mario Galento. But anyway.
Well, Joe, we're getting ready to wind down here, but I appreciate you getting in here. Give us a call sometime.
All right, I'll do that. I enjoy listening to y'all. Y'all having a pretty good conversation.
All right. Thanks a lot. Let me put you back on hold. I got Charlie Smith. That's he's paying me for airtime now. Hey Charlie, how are you doing tonight?
You awake?
Charlie.
Can you hear?
You're on, Charlie.
He must not have the hearing aid then.
I can hear him breathing.
Guys, I did hear from Jerry while we were on the air. He said some sad news, I guess, here. He said he lost his childhood friend, been close ever since, and him and Ted are going to be going to Columbus on Sunday for a funeral. So I guess sad time for him and Ted at this point.
I'd love
him. Sorry to hear that.
And, let's see. We'll get Charlie one more chance here. Charlie.
Yeah.
There he is.
I'm here.
Yeah. Well, you're paying me for airtime. What you got for us tonight?
I like to thank Bobby and Jay for saying the nice things they said about me. Which
well,
you know, all true anyway.
Well, it, I'm expecting the check tomorrow, Charlie, so just.
Well, Bobby does too.
I'll just settle. You can buy supper tomorrow.
Anybody else want to go with us?
Did we tell any lies about you, Charlie?
No, I don't tell no lies, sir. I speak the truth all the time.
No, I know you do. I just wondered if you thought we said anything about you that wasn't true.
Oh, everything was true, sir.
Oh, okay.
Very true. Richard, you could not get together?
It looks like I might be. It's been a while since I've been there.
It's the first time he's been in a long time.
I might have to reschedule.
Well, you know what? It worked out for me, too, so there you go.
Good, 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 good.
Good. We'll have a good crowd. Well, Charlie, everybody's got to bring something.
Charlie, you got any comments on any of the other people that went in the class with you that we've been talking about tonight?
You know, I went to Pensacola to be a special referee. Me and my wife, we were sitting at that ringside waiting for the doors open and everything, then we was going to go back to the restroom. And Mario came out. My wife said, "That's Mario Glento." I said, "No, that ain't Mario. He looked like Superman. He had muscle up and everything. He looked good." And so later on that night, Bob Armstrong told me, he said, "Me and Rod Fuller was out on the beach. And Mario was out there. He said, all the girls were around Mario instead of me and Bob." But he looked real good, old. And the hang of this was the work. It wasn't no work. It was the truth. He put that on, it hurt.
Charlie, you got anything on Gorgeous George from when he was here?
No, didn't I? The only thing I know about Gorgeous George Jr., we were...
Not junior, senior.
No, I don't know nothing about him.
Okay.
I think I worked with it one time, that was all.
All right. What about...
I can't remember.
What about the Anderson brothers?
Worked a lot of time with them. Lots of time. And I see Ole every once in a while, once or twice a month. I go have lunch with him down in Monroe. And
he's in bed.
He's not doing too good. His memory is getting a little bit gone too. And you know, of course he can't walk or he can't do nothing without Marcia helping him. And he said that everybody's against him, all his family, everybody but his son, Brian, and he's a lawyer now. And but he forgets a lot of things too right now, which is I hate that because smart, like you say, he was a smart booker and everything. And Ole was Ole. He didn't like you. And but he was wrong in a lot of ways. But he apologized. He apologized to me. He thought I was stealing his money, which was true.
He thought everybody was stealing his money.
I know it, yeah. And he asked me one time, he said, "Where did you get all your money?" And I said, "Working for you, stealing from you." He said, "I knew you were stealing. I knew you were stealing." But I tried to explain to him, and he finally capped out that he was wrong. But a lot of guys, they still hold grudges against.
Life's too short for that nonsense, my boy.
Yes, sir, Reed. You got that right.
Well, hey, Charlie, next time you see Ole, tell him hello for us.
All right, yeah, I'll probably see him one day next week. I have lunch with him.
All right.
And I hope to see you at get together, sir. And everybody, good night, gentlemen.
Good night, man.
Good night, Charlie. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from y'all, too. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, guys. Any last thoughts before we wrap up tonight?
Well, I enjoyed
this. I did, too. I thought with Jerry not here to add his comments that we would be short on time, but we've gone almost 2 hours here. So I guess we do like to talk, huh, Bobby?
I guess. I've made this statement, and this is just in closing. This is the truth if I've ever told it. When Rich first asked me to do this show, man, I gave him every reason in the world why I couldn't do it. And he told me, he said, "Please just try it." And I did. And honest to goodness, this is my favorite hour, 2 hours, however long we go. I look so forward to this every week. Just talking and you know, I mean, there's something about this stupid business that once you're involved in it, the only people that understand you really are the people that were involved and or are involved. And it just, I look forward to it. And I have a ball, man. I just appreciate y'all letting me be part of this. This is fun to me.
Well, you got some great stories.
Absolutely. Absolutely. An encyclopedia, man. We love picking that brain.
Huh. Well, you better do it quick because I don't know how much longer it's going to last. The warranty's about out.
All right. Well, guys, next week I got a work thing that's going to tie me up on Thursday night. So next week's out, but we'll see you about 2 weeks from tonight. And unless you guys have something else, that's it.
That
for
sounds good.
I enjoyed it.
All right. Good night, guys.
All right.
Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.